Well, it's a very much a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to give you this talk about millikelvin detectors. So pictured here are actually some of the super CDMS detectors. I'm from the Super CDMS Collaboration, but I'm actually going to be talking about several experiments today, not just my own. So this morning, and actually throughout the conference, earlier in the conference today, I think already the case for low mass dark matter has been made, but just as sort of a reminder, let me remind you that there has been a lot of work that has gone into looking for the canonical WIMP. But so far, we haven't had any evidence from either direct searches or from the LHC have we had any evidence of dark matter detection or from SUSY of there being any dark matter. And so if it is that we just broaden our thoughts a little bit and we loosen our cosmology and our theory priors, we can still have reasonable dark matter candidates, and many of them have lower masses. And so for the focus of this talk and for millikelvin detectors, most of those dark matter, where much of the sensitivity lies, is sort of in this 300 MeV to kind of the 10 GeV range. And although with these sort of millikelvin detectors, you can have access to higher mass WIMPs, and perhaps even lower mass WIMPs, where they're strongest or perhaps most effective or most competitive are in this range. This morning, Jocelyn had sort of outlined already for us the detection principles and operation principles behind these detectors. But just in case you weren't paying attention or you weren't here because you came a little bit late, let me remind you, the basic idea is that your dark matter particle is going to interact with the detector, either a nucleus or perhaps even an electron, and deposit some sort of recoiling energy. And this energy then would be detected by the instrument, either in this case in the form of phonons, light, or ionization energy. And in this talk, there are three experiments that I'm going to talk about: Super CDMS, Edelweiss, and CREST-3. There are some other experiments that are operating around the world that do have sensitivity as well, but these I would argue at this point are probably the leading experiments in this field, and so I'm going to focus on them because I have a limited amount of time. So the basic idea is that you're going to have the elastic scattering of a WIMP depositing a small amount of energy into a recoiling nucleus. Jocelyn showed us a plot that looks similar to this morning for high mass WIMPs. Notice my plot is slightly different than hers. Hers had threshold energies that went up more like 40 keV, and that's because she had done this plot for a WIMP that had a mass of 100 GeV. This plot here is showing you what your event rates would look like if your WIMP had a mass of 10 GeV. In that case, this here is what your threshold or what your count rate would look like in 10 kilograms of material. So this is counts for 10 kilograms of material per year. So what you can see is that your threshold energy is much, much lower. So knowing your energy scale and your efficiencies in these types of detectors is going to be really critical. The scale, the energy scale, it's featureless, it's exponential. There's no obvious knees or peaks that you can use to sort of distinguish what this is going to look like. The event rate is very, very low. This is one event. And the radioactivity, as Jocelyn had pointed out this morning, the radioactivity background of most of the materials that you might construct your experiment out of is higher than your event rate. And so these experiments are very, very challenging to build. And so as such, and as Jocelyn had pointed out, we site these experiments underground. That is sort of our first line of defense. That reduces the cosmic induced backgrounds. We use active and passive shielding. So this is showing you the Edelweiss active muon and passive shielding. This is an example of the Super CDMS Sudan experiments, passive shielding. This experiment is no longer running, but it just gives you an example of the type of shielding that these experiments use. In addition, these materials are screened and assayed and carefully selected before they're put into place. Most of the time, the materials that you're looking for, you're looking for materials that have less than one part per billion uranium or thorium in their content. And so working with vendors to try to figure out what that is before you put them in. And you use this information when you're constructing your background models that you're putting into your experiments. All right, so that's sort of just the general background that sort of goes into any of the experiments that I'm going to talk about. And so now I'm going to talk specifically about these three different experiments, give you an idea of how their technology and how each experiment goes about addressing these different problems. The technologies all have similar components, but each one addresses them slightly differently, and then give you an idea of some of the recent results from each of them. So I'm going to start with Super CDMS. So the Super CDMS technology, so here you're looking at a picture of the Super CDMS iZip and the Super CDMS High Voltage ZIP. These are detectors that will go into the Snow Lab site. This is the next generation, the Generation 2 Super CDMS Snow Lab experiment. Super CDMS Snow Lab is going to use ultra-pure kilogram-sized germanium and silicon crystals that are operated at tens of millikelvin. They measure athermal phonon signals via a transition edge technology, so that's a TES. They have multiple channel readout, and so here are sort of schematics of what the channels look like for the iZip and the high voltage detectors. Each of the detectors have an alter guard ring to fiducialize the detectors so that you can veto events that happen at high radius to get rid of some surface events. The detectors have very good surface and bulk discrimination by looking at something that's called charge face symmetry. So the idea being that if your event comes in, what you're looking at here is sort of a cross-section of the detector and the electric field lines. This here is sort of a blow-up of the top surface of the detector and the electric field lines here. And so the idea is that if an event comes in and interacts in the bulk of the crystals, the electric field is set up in such a way that the electrons drift in one direction and the holes in another direction. And so the charge will be collected equally on the top face and the bottom face of the detector. If you were to have an event interact near the top face of the detector, or similarly, if you were near the bottom face of the detector, you have basically the phonon sensors are here, and they're interleaved with the charge sensors, which are positively biased in this case, and then the phonon sensors are acting as a ground. So the holes will go in one direction, the electrons will go in the other direction, but they're all being collected on one side of the detector. And so essentially, if I were to look at the symmetry, there would be no charge for this event collected on this side of the detector, and all the charge would be collected on this face of the detector. And so I would have an asymmetric charge collection for that event. This works very, very well in getting rid of surface events, which are a major concern for these types of detectors. So the Super CDMS technology, like I said, it sort of has these two different detectors. And even when these detectors were run in their previous incarnation at Sudan, the Sudan, Minnesota site, there were two modes of operation. The standard iZip mode, or the CDMS light, or this high voltage mode, are the two modes of operation. And so let me tell you the difference between these two different modes. In the iZip mode, these primary or prompt initial phonons and ionization signals allowed for discrimination between nuclear recoil and electron recoil events by the simultaneous measurement of both the charge and the phonon signal. Okay, and so the idea being that when a WIMP would come in, essentially you're measuring both the charge and the phonon signal at the same time. And these would be collected differently. And I have a plot on the next page that will show you how you can distinguish between these two events. In the CDMS high voltage mode, what you do instead is you essentially crank up the electric field. So in this mode of operation, the detectors are run at 3 or 4 volts. In this mode of operation, we're running the detectors at Sudan. We ran them at 70 volts. In snow lab, we'll probably run them at about 100 volts. So you crank up the electric field. And when you do that, what happens is as you drift the electrons across this electric field, what you're doing is you actually create more phonons as you drift the charge through the electric field. By cranking up the electric field, you're generating more phonons as you're drifting the charge through the higher electric field. And so what this does is you end up generating a larger number of phonons, and this essentially what it does is it gives you the ability to go to very, very low thresholds and get a much larger resolution or charge resolution of the energy of the events that you're collecting. The trade-off is when you're running in this mode, you give up the ability to distinguish between a nuclear recoil and an electron recoil. And so a nuclear recoil is when your event is interacting with the nucleus. An electron recoil is when your event is interacting with the electron in your crystal. And the reason that is important, in case it wasn't clear from this morning, is that WIMPs, your dark matter candidate, will interact with the nucleus, and your background particles will interact with the electron. That's why it was always very important to know that discrimination. So now, comparing the two different operation modes side by side, here's the high voltage mode. This is the iZip mode. So going over here, let's start with the iZip mode. This is the ionization yield versus recoil energy. And so electron recoils will have an ionization yield. So ionization yield is your charge energy divided by your phonon energy, and that will be 1 for your background events. And for your nuclear recoil or your signal light events, that ratio will be about 0.3. And so that signal band is represented here in green. So what you're looking at here is actually a plot of the surface events, which I said are something that are problematic. And this plot here is actually demonstrating, it's actually from a rejection paper we had showing how great this surface symmetry charge, surface symmetry cut is working. So what you're seeing here in blue are all events that pass. These are surface events that were generated by a calibration source. And in blue are events from the bulk that passed the surface symmetry cut. So these are symmetric events from the bulk of the crystal. And in red are events that were on the surface that were rejected by the cut. So this rejection is really, really great. This is over 75,000 events. On the left-hand side here is showing you basically events that you're getting from this low threshold or this high voltage mode. And so what you can see is very cleanly activation lines in the germanium from the L shell, the K shell, and even M shell electrons. And so this here is actually WIMP search data from our PRL. Then this is from the Super CDMS Sudan experiment. And so recent results from the CDMS run 2 that was run at Sudan, you can see here are the limits that were most recently published from being able to run in that CDMS light mode. This is the cross section for a spin independent interaction versus WIMP mass. So future prospects, we actually still have some data that hasn't been analyzed yet from Sudan. We are busy analyzing the CDMS run 3 results, and we do have some projections of our sensitivity for that. Hopefully those results will come out soonish, but I have no promises like Elena as it being out in the next few weeks. But we are busy trying to finish up this analysis, and I expect you will see that sometime soon. I also mentioned that we are also working on Super CDMS Sudan. So this will have an initial payload of 4 towers with 6 detectors each. 2 of the towers will be high voltage, 2 will be iZips, and lots of work has been done here, including background modeling. And so this will have background subtraction is something that we plan to do. And then, as promised, we have this prototype detector that Reuven had announced that I would mention during my talk today. So In some sense, for a long time, one of the things that we have been very interested in doing is be able to do single electron hole pair resolution as a goal for super CDMS. And back in October, our R&D team had demonstrated single hole pair resolution in a test device. And so this is a picture of the test device here. And what you're looking at here is basically the phonon energy. And so what you're looking at here is the number of electron hole pairs. So this is a single electron hole pair, two electron hole pairs, three electron hole pairs. And these Gaussians here, what you're looking at is the phonons quantizing around those electron hole pairs. And so this was demonstrated in essentially a 1 gram silicon crystal. And the reason that this is so interesting to us is that this will give us sensitivity to sub-GeV dark matter models using just gram day exposures, as Ruben had said. The other interesting thing is that this is for electron dark matter. It also potentially will give us the ability to get sensitivity back and the ability to reject our discrimination between nuclear recoils and electron recoils back again as well, because nuclear recoils will not quantize in this way. This is showing basically the analysis that was recently put on the archive on Monday from a run with this same crystal. The exposure was 0.49 gram days, operated at 140 volts. The data, we did do a data analysis, so there was a data selection criteria applied. So basically what you can look at here, so again, you can see the quantization going on. We do have some Monte Carlo that was done to try to, the Monte Carlo here is essentially a fit to a background model of the of what we thought the background was, but we did not do a background subtraction for this analysis because I know that Reuven probably will ask me that. This basically is just showing us before and after the cuts, what our efficiencies were. When you put this all together, here are the limits that Reuven said. So basically we had dark photon limits that are very consistent with what Domek and the Xenon collaboration has already put out there. Perhaps we have just a little sliver more here. And then we also have for ER dark matter, so this is electron recoiling dark matter with a heavy and a light mediator, where we have maybe shaved out a bit more space. The red line here is our limit using a Fano factor of 0.15, and then the shaded region is showing you basically with systematics. All right, so in the last few minutes that I have, let me quickly show you some results from other experiments. So CREST technology actually uses a scintillating crystal. So they are measuring both light and phonons, and they use this TES technology as well to read out phonon signals. So this is very similar to CDMS, but they also use a light absorber, which is silicon on sapphire, to collect an ionization signal. And for those of you who don't know what a TES is, this is great. It's basically a transition edge sensor that sits on its superconducting edge. So a very small change in temperature creates a big change in resistance that you can read out with electronics. They get discrimination based on measuring the ratio of their light to scintillization energy versus their recoil energy. And so they get, again, their background particles. And then this here is where their nuclear recoils are on either the oxygen, calcium, or tungsten. And then alphas are another background that they have. They have these cuboidal crystals right here. So this is just basically a picture of their detector. One of the big improvements that they had was this iStick. This is something that I think Laura had mentioned in one of the discussion sessions earlier related to one of the other technologies that was discussed earlier in the week. This was one of the major improvements over their previous technology. They were, in their previous generation, dominated by backgrounds. And so backgrounds are a real, real big thing. So this was a really big improvement to them, was coming up with this iStick technology, which is right here. Which I think just kind of blows my mind that you would think something so little could be so critical to your experiment. I'm sorry I'm going fast through this, but it's because I'm short of time. So they had 5 detectors that met their design goals, but their first results were basically only on detector A. And again, you can see here, similar to CDMS, they have this really nice energy resolution where you can see, these nice activation lines. This is their results as far as once they unblinded their data. So in red here are the events that they had in their region of interest. They assumed all the events were a result of dark matter interactions. And so similar to super CDMS, they used the Yellen optimal interval method to set limits. And this red solid line here are their limits for this analysis. So outlook, so they had just reported initially their results here on detector A, which was their best detector with their best threshold. This here, detector basically had a 3 times lower optimal threshold than what their design goal was. And they have 3 more detectors that have met their design goal. And so they still have that data to analyze, plus they are ongoing taking data. So we are looking forward to them having more results in the future. And finally, in my last couple of minutes, I want to give you an idea of what Edelweiss is doing. Their technology is also similar to CDMS. They use germanium targets. Their crystals are a little bit bigger. Their electrodes also are interleaved like CDMS, but different than CDMS, they use an NTD heat sensor, so they don't collect athermal, these prompt phonons, but their phonons tend to be thermalized, and they have guard rings all the way around the edge of their detector here too, their electrodes. And so, but they have the same idea as far as fiducializing their volume through the surface events, but their field lines look a little bit different. Their detector performance is very, very good. They have event by event separation down to about 5 keV. You can see here that their response to nuclear recoils looks very, very well. Their recent data analysis has been published. Their data is driven using background models, using sidebands, so they have bulk electron recoils. They have neutrons, which are in here, surface beta, and then heat-only events down here. Using that, they derived these limits here, doing both a boosted decision tree and a profile likelihood analysis. They also are working on techniques very similar to what Super CDMS is using in order to drive down their thresholds. So they are using this Luke Neginov technique to boost their detectors to go to these much lower thresholds, much in the same way as Super CDMS, trying to improve their resolution. They have achieved 2 of these goals. They are working on these last 2 still, and they have projections of where to go. So let me conclude and say that dark matter experiments have been very successful in ruling out a number of favored candidates. Millikelvin detectors are making fast progress in pushing our technologies to lower thresholds and accessing smaller cross sections. And I think that you should stay tuned. And I think that the future is really bright. I'm sorry, I wrote a 25-minute talk because I didn't know it was 20.
So we have maybe a little less questions, but a couple of questions maybe is okay.
And one of your slides mentioned salting. I just wondered if you could say any more about the salting technique you used.
It did. And I kind of ran through it really quick because I wanted to mention it. Yes. So the question was, so Sally had asked, one of the slides talked about the Super CDMS Sudan Light CDMS Light Run 3 is using a technique called salting. So it's a blinding technique. And so there are several different techniques that people in our community, well, it's not really even our community's technique. We stole it from somebody else, probably collider physicists, and who knows where they stole it from. But the idea is that what you would, different people come up with different techniques to make sure that they're not biased against their data. And one of the techniques that you can do is you can sprinkle fake events into your data in order to remove the bias. And so this is essentially the technique that we're using in CDMS Lite Run 3. And we can discuss offline if you want exactly the technique the exact implementation of how we're doing this with this data. But that's essentially what you do, is that you take events that are fake, you salt them into the data. And so we've done it in this way, is it actually is Ray Bunker, who is the person who put the salt in, and now he's been excluded from being able to do any of the analysis. If I remember correctly, it's either him or it might be Ben Lohr who did it. It's one of those two who is involved.
You look at this plot, it's telling us that, say, at 1 GeV, a particle with a cross section of 10 to the minus 40 centimeters squared is excluded because, in this case, crest or whatever.
It's not excluded yet. Okay, so let me say this. In this plot, the lines that are dotted are projections, solid lines are exclusions at probably the 90% confidence level in most cases. It's what's reported by the experiments.
Let's take 90.
So
you have expected 2.7 events for 5 GeV 10 to the minus 39, which is one of my favorite candidates.
Right? Okay.
And you say that you didn't see these events. Now, in order for you to see these events with the threshold quoted by this detector, that particle would have had to be moving at, I was trying to estimate in my head, about 600 kilometers per second in order to give you a recoil. So you are really sampling the high velocity tail of the dark matter distribution. And you are, of course, assuming it, as everyone does, to be a Maxwellian distribution with some parameters.
Yes.
Now, all it would take for you not to see those events is if those high velocity particles were not there.
Okay? Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Right. So this is, of course, a well-recognized point, but since, for obvious reasons, experimentalists still like to show plots in this plane.
He's always assume a 540.
I should have known better than not to put up all the caveats on this slide.
We all know the caveats, et cetera, but psychologically, to see your favorite candidate ruled out by an experiment, which has a definite bold line ruling it out, I think it's really important when we are then trying to compare experiments which have different thresholds.
Yes,
that
absolutely.
We really go to a hello independent method of comparing them, because otherwise, there has been progress, all the experiments are at least now using the same parameters. At one time, you'll recall, people were using their own choices of the cutoff velocity or whatever. But bottom line is very simple. Are the particles with the necessary large velocities to give you the little recoils that you're now sensitive to, do they actually exist in the halo? This is the question. This is not addressed to you.
This is certainly something for others in the audience, and I think there's a gentleman with his hand in the back who might want to say something regarding that.
Ideally, if you can tell the escape velocity of the galaxy, then absolute minimum is 650, so you would expect to have some distribution up to that. In most of the simulations, the late infall actually makes the tails a bit heavy, and so there's more than you would expect. But of course, the details of infall, in any case we know of, the Milky Way is always special.
Yes.
Yeah. And I can say, as soon as anybody sees a signal and somebody doesn't see it, and that happens any time, like back when...
Last time it happened was CDMS.
Cogent. And we were spending an awful lot of time trying to understand why Cogent was possibly seeing signals and people, even... I think that becomes a theorist and phenomenologist and astrophysics playground when there are hints of signals and in some experiments and not in others, until it becomes to the point where it becomes clearer whether it was an instrumental effect or whether it was something real. But this is just a way that we can
absolutely
compare things.
These are pretty complicated.
From the discussion we had later.
I totally different question. I was wondering, You know, after CDMS moved away from NTDs and focusing on TES readout, Edelweiss still using NTDs.
Yes.
How does that look now? How do you see the advantages, disadvantages of what Super CDMS is doing and Edelweiss?
So
now that we have several results.
So in my opinion, my opinion is probably quite biased. I think that the TES technology has a lot of advantages to it, especially looking at going towards low mass. I think we have had a lot more success advancing the technology quicker in that way. I think when it was that we wanted to scale up like the high mass region, I think the NTD was the way to go. I think you didn't need to have those athermal phonons going quite as quick. And to be quite frank, when it was that we were when we were in the race to do something bigger and faster, I wasn't convinced that having to do the TSs were necessarily needed. I think that they give you a lot of information that you can't get from the NTDs, and I thought maybe the NTDs were sufficient. But I think now that we're trying to go into this low mass range, I think the TSs are the way to go. But I think maybe Matt Pyle or somebody who works more with the technology might even have a stronger opinion than I would. But that's my feeling.
I have a quick question about the high voltage result.
Sure.
So slide 16. So in the data, there seem to be events that go pretty high in electron hole pairs. Is it clear what those are?
Let's see.
Like
here?
Events, yeah, the pink or magenta, it just sort of a flat background.
Way up here?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear. So actually, one of the things that we did is this right now, to me, I'm not sure what these are, what all these events are. And the idea here is that this was just sort of a simple model of what could be sort of your ionization, your dark ionization, to show that we could get a reasonable fit. And we think that we could better understand the background, given more time and given some more time to model it and study it, and that perhaps we could get an even better limit if we did some background modeling, given some more time with the data. But we wanted to get a result out quickly, and that's why we chose to go with the optimal interval method and not do a background subtraction here and do a complete background modeling. But with time, we think we can better model everything that's going on. People who work more closely with the analysis, Matt Pyle, might have a better idea of what those events are at higher energy, but I don't.
Okay, I think we should continue. We have half an hour discussion, or maybe 15 minutes. I have a question only on this one. Poor detector performance, because it's 16 hours, is it? Is this 16 hours over a long period of time, or is it continuous?
So, well, it's actually, basically, I think it was about 50%.
On off?
Yeah, 50%. And so, basically, there would be like trigger bursts and things like this. So, there's essentially three quality cuts that were made during this performance. Period, and so essentially it's about roughly speaking, it's a 50% reduction that you're seeing in the efficiency model, and you can kind of see that here.
1 week.
I mean, this is not very much data that was taken.